This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we are discussing Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, chapters 13 and 14, the Muggleborn Registration Commission and the Thief. In these chapters, more of Umbridge.
She is one twisted, twisted person.
We'll talk more in depth about that. And we be chilling in a forest.
Chilling in the forest, having some dreams or whatever.
Having some dreams and eating some half-baked mushrooms.
Yeah.
And not like the trippy kind either.
I was just going to say, it sounds like a great Saturday night. I've never done mushrooms. Okay. So, sorry.
Yep. Alrighty. So first we begin with chapter 13, the Muggleborn Registration Commission. And, you know, we get a fuller scope and witness exactly what's going on in terms of, you know, rounding up the Muggleborns, which we already knew from Remus Lupin that was happening. And then in that chapter, you know, we did all of the, all the typical, allusions and allegories of, you know, the Jews and Nazi Germany and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But now we get up close and personal, and, you know, they're in the ministry, they're in the elevator, and they bump into Umbridge with her little clipboard.
Yeah, she's pretty psyched to be in this position, I feel like. I feel like all these people in these positions of power are just like, I mean, why else would you kind of follow some nasty person down into the depths of hell? But
indeed. And it's just interesting. And it's interesting to read Harry being like, you know, they get separated because, you know, obviously the people they're impersonating have very specific roles in the ministry. Like, they can't just, you know, huddle together. And they're thinking like, oh my God, we spent all our time just getting in. We didn't have a clue about what to do once in, and no plan if we got separated.
Did not think that part through, which Hermione's with them, right? So
in essence, like, they all get separated at some point. Ron has to go fix the whatever problem that his guy he's impersonating, he's expected to fix. Hermione's person, Mafalda, you know, she has to go with Umbridge, and then that leaves Harry by himself.
Yeah. I just think, I mean, Hermione usually thinks things through, kind of. Maybe she hasn't. I feel like I've also remember a time when she didn't, but I can't remember the specifics. So,
Well, when she ran off to get the centaurs to get rid of Umbridge, that was really, really well thought out to a certain extent. But again, in the same way, she's not, you know, culturally savvy enough to know what the house elves wants. She failed miserably in how centaurs would receive her being like, oh, I used you to get rid of my enemy.
So it's just a lack of, like, just lack of growing up.
Yeah, well, again,
in that world.
And again, she does have blind spots, you know, based on her privilege, which is, I think, typical of a lot of white women. You know, we're in this weird position white women are, which is something I've had to, you know, constantly be cognizant of, is like, yeah, I receive discrimination to a certain extent, but at the same time, I'm also the trophy, and therefore I know I'm not having it nearly as bad as other groups.
Yeah. Excuse me. That was horrible. Yeah. And I think when you're talking about the trophy, it's in a Are you talking mainly about like in a relationship way?
Like, I mean, yeah, in a patriarchal way.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
You know, because there's a whole bunch of studies about like in history, like in a lot of nationalist movement that, you know, there are so many paintings of in the 19th century, like when they were depicting, you know, certain European countries and Slavic countries, liberation from the Ottoman Empire, they would portray the downtrodden, you know, European, what we consider European nation, as the white woman. And then in the background is the evil, you know, dark skinned Moor or Ottoman.
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah. So anyway, so then, you know, Mafalda has to go, or Hermione, who is impersonating Mafalda, has to go with Umbridge. And we get the Minister of Magic, Pious Thickness. And so we know from the beginning of the book that Pious Thickness was at least under the Imperius Curse.
Oh, yeah.
But his level of bigotry that he's showing here, I guess it, you know, I had a lot of questions in these two chapters about the nature of certain elements of magic. And so, you know, in Pious Thickness' case, you know, he gets, you know, Harry's like trying to BS him, oh, I need a word with Arthur Weasley. And he's like, oh, has he been caught having contact with the undesirable? No, nothing like that. Ah, well, it's only a matter of time. And for whatever reason, Jim Dale gives Thickness a very Irish accent.
Yeah.
So, if you ask me, the blood traitors are as bad as the mudbloods. So, you know, again, showing this bigoted behavior. And so it just makes me think about how all-encompassing is the Imperius Curse in terms of, you know, because when you cast someone with the Imperius Curse, obviously you're giving them directives. But I would think to, like, change vital parts of their personality, you would be having to give very, very specific directives in the same way that Harry has to give so many directives to make sure Creature doesn't try and find a loophole.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. I guess I didn't remember this element, and now rereading it again, and quite frankly, in my previous rereadings, like, I've kind of glazed over Deathly Hallows because, again, it's traditionally my least favorite. But yeah, just coming back to this, and at first, like, coming back to this and being like, oh, I feel sad for Sickness. He's under the Imperius Curse. He's totally lacking agency. But it's just like, with this stuff, it's like, oh, like, how much of this is Imperius and how much of this is really like him?
Yeah, I mean, I guess this assumption can be like somebody is very much the opposite. And if they're, so does the Imperius Curse also control ideology? We don't really know.
And then, of course, there's the theory, which I feel like we, you know, everyone, you know, a lot of people make the argument that obviously Donald Trump did not create racism. He did not create sexism. But by behaving the way he does on a global stage, he gives legitimacy and credence to people who traditionally thought, oh, I can't voice these racist or sexist views I have in polite society because mainstream culture has, you know, evolved to a certain point. And now it's like, oh, I can say it now. So I think there's a sense of maybe he was on the Imperius Curse, put under the Imperius Curse, because at least at the superficial level, he was being very restrained in terms of what his true views were. You know, and now that the system, that the anti-Muggle-born system is in place, he's just like, okay, screw it. I can say whatever I want now.
Maybe. I'm one of those people that think that, you know, Trump is, of course, all those things, but he really kind of just made himself like showed that you can be in the most powerful position in the world and then also be a total, complete, horrible person.
Yeah. Alrighty then, we're 8 minutes into this and we haven't gotten to the third page, so let's continue. So Harry goes sneaking off trying to find Umbridge's office. And so while he's trying to find her office, he sees a bunch of, you know, people creating these pamphlets.
Oh, yeah.
And he examined it beneath the invisibility cloak. Its pink cover was emblazoned with golden title, Mudbloods and the Dangers They Pose to a Peaceful Pure Blood Society. Beneath the title was a picture of a red rose with a simpering face in the middle of its petals being strangled by a green weed with fangs and a scowl. Wow. There was no author's name upon the pamphlet, but again, the scars on the back of his right hand seemed to tingle as he examined it. So, yeah, this comes to my note. We were just off mic discussing. So again, my note that I've got here is, you know, the notion of like propaganda and this sort of, again, I think when Remus brought up these issues in the previous, chapters, you know, I did talk about how like literally Nazis try to justify their crappy stuff with pseudoscience, you know, with a bunch of quack science to legitimize their eugenics, blah, blah, blah. But for more modern renditions of this sort of propaganda is protect the children.
Yeah.
And I specifically think about it in the, you know, in certain rhetoric in ways that to the way that certain elements of society are construing LGBTQ plus inclusion as sexualization of children and being predatory towards them and grooming them and all sorts of other BS.
It's amazing the how people can pick and choose what is sexualization. I mean, I feel like if anybody wants to talk about that or like a fear of that, then like go to a beauty pageant. Like, what the hell is that? Or talk to, you know, how people talk to little kids, like, oh, is that your boyfriend? They're 5 years old. Like, yeah. But you can't have a drag queen read a story at like, I don't know. The logic.
Yeah. And is sound. You know, I've been just the times we're living in right now in the culture wars and the specific book of Harry Potter we're reading, a lot of my allegories are going to be towards the LGBTQ plus community. And especially that's at the forefront of my mind is, I think I mentioned to you off mic, that basically Indiana's own version, House Bill 1608, its own version of Don't Say Gay, like going through the House. And there was some protest the other day. And yeah, like just simply acknowledging that they exist and they're not evil is sexualization.
Yeah. I have a lot of strong feelings about that for a lot of reasons. Yeah, acknowledgement of existence is, it just doesn't make sense. And that's what's always frustrated me. Also, it just doesn't make sense. And yeah. I don't understand the Don't Say Gay bills because, again, it just does not make sense. So, whatever, people.
But so as they're making these propaganda pamphlets, Harry overhears them. It's like, careful, she may hear you. And it's like, what, has she got a magic ears as well as an eye now? And Harry realizes that on Umbridge's office door is the big electric blue eye that once was Mad-Eye Moody's.
And that's why I said she's a sick person. Because that's pretty, like, trophy serial killer. Blech,
yeah, that's serious trophy serial killer. And it just goes to show, you know, how, you know, even though Voldemort is not in a political position, just how deeply embedded the Death Eaters now are, because we know Dolores Umbridge, you know, she's not directly a Death Eater. She wasn't flying on brooms chasing Harry with Voldemort, so she certainly wouldn't have been there to retrieve to retrieve Moody's body in any way, shape, or form. But somehow, you know, she's high enough in the ministry that when the Death Eaters did get a hold of it and got that eye, somehow it was decided that Umbridge is gonna get the eye.
That's pretty messed up. That's all I can think. There are a couple of things like thus far in this book have just been very sinister. And that is just a very, you know, I think that's why Umbridge is always so fascinating to me, is because she is a very sinister character masquerading as, you know, they talk about her pink paper and her pink this, and then she's got the little kittens and the lace and all this stuff. She's very confusing.
Yeah, so I have one of my notes is the war on pink, and just reminding myself that Harry the writer, this was written at a time in the 90s and early aughts where the whole cultural brand, the specific manifestation of feminism at that time was to completely disregard and diminish things that are traditionally very feminine. And which, you know, and then our more recent renditions of feminism have more taken the approach of, well, if you do that, then you're just reinforcing the idea that the de facto status of things is masculinity and what masculinity looks like.
Like, as a woman, no matter what you do, it's going to be wrong. I feel like men don't get, like, if you're you're being too tomboy or you're being too masculine, which is, you know, you should embrace your femininity. If you embrace your femininity, you're not.
You're a vapid, shallow bitch.
You're a vapid, shallow bitch. So it feels like, and what is this all doing pitting women against each other? So, because I kind of tend to fall in more of the tomboy category, but that doesn't mean I don't like, you know, feminine things. I do, and I'm not going to shame other women for that. But the other thing that I was thinking about with the color pink in specific is she who shall not be named. She's not anti-gay, is she?
As far as we know, I don't think so. At least going as far to queerbait by saying after the series that Dumbledore is gay.
Because there's a strong association with pink in the gay community, you know, like with in the little pink triangles that people had to wear. So I didn't know if this was like her kind of messed up way of trying to, I don't know, screw up the pink.
I always took, you know, looking at it now, I always take Umbridge's pinkness as a means of the writing of the time of demonizing super feminine things.
That makes sense. And I think she's a TERF, she's not necessarily anti-gay.
Okay. Yeah.
All right, sure. I'm done talking about her.
Yeah, so am I. And so Harry is, you know, shuffling through her office trying to find stuff, says Accio Locket, and doesn't find anything. And he's looking in some of the cabinets and he finds a file on Arthur Weasley.
Of course.
Yeah, pure blood status, but with unacceptable pro-muggle leanings, known member of the Order of the Phoenix, wife, pure blood, 7 children, you know, youngest son currently at home, seriously ill, ministry inspectors have confirmed. So Ron's ghoul idea has worked.
Yeah.
Security status tracked. All movements are being monitored. Strong likelihood undesirable number one will contact. And Harry's like, oh, who's undesirable number one? Take a stab in the dark.
Yeah, exactly. He knows exactly who it is.
Himself. And then, and on his poster with his face is a little pink sticky note, you know, that in Umbridge's handwriting has says to be punished. And so, you know, one of my notes is, well, two elements. What is Umbridge's whole game or style? Because, again, I very much think of her as, you know, being the sort of type of villain that honestly has no direct political ideologies or moral conviction. She just chases the power and will just go along with whoever's in power to get some power of her own. You know, I've always viewed her like that. And also, if that is, you know, if that is her game, if that is her game, why does she seem to have this such a personal vendetta against Harry?
I think she would have been more successful as a dominatrix. Let's just put that out there. But I don't know. Is there like some past with the Potters, like his parents
that no.
we don't know about? Because she's too old, right? Or
I don't know if she's too old, but I can tell you there's nothing like that. It just seems her specific obsession with Harry and being a sadist towards Harry, you know, at least at a superficial level in my mind, seems to be in direct contradiction with my previous assessment that, you know, she doesn't have her own, like, direct political ideologies or moral conviction. She just chases the power.
She does not have any children or she's not married.
She doesn't have any of that. She doesn't have her own family.
Do you think it's like a little bit of, I don't know, like, retaliation because she's doesn't ha- I mean I almost kind of see some messed up way, and that's very cliched trope, I think, because she has like really wants something she can't have, and Harry represents a lot of the things that she wishes she had. I don't know.
Or like, again, like the only way it works is that she sees Harry as like her downfall of her losing power in her stint at Hogwarts. And, you know, and is keeping a grudge from that. Because, again, if things were to flip and Harry somehow got into political power, you know, she'd be kissing his ass.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So. So, yeah. Anyway, it's just an interesting dynamic of seeing this very personally motivated form of sadism and revenge and hatred towards an individual while she's fluidly, you know, navigating a system and appealing to those, you know, currently in power.
Yeah, she just sucks. Yeah. That's her general,
which again, but... which is why she is so much more intimidating as a villain than Voldemort, because Voldemort is just screaming, like, kill the, you know, kill this one group, whereas, you know, Umbridge is like, I'll do it, but I'll do it in a sneakier way.
Yeah. Yeah, those people are always a little more difficult to deal with.
Yep. And so Harry, what do we got? You know, with all of this. Oh, and then he, in Umbridge's office, Harry also finds a copy of Rita Skeeter's book, The Life and Lies of Albus Dumbledore.
Of course.
Yep. And
she wouldn't want to read that.
Yep. Takes that, and then Harry goes back into the elevators, the lifts, because we're in Britain.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And who, so, and who does he bump into?
The thickness,
well, first he
right?
gets, he gets, he find, he reunites his Ron.
Okay. Yes.
Yep. And then, but then Arthur Weasley comes into the elevator.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Sorry. Yes, I remember this. Which is a little awkward, and just because, I don't know, I kind of imagined myself in that position, and Ron is like, he's just kind of like, I know he knows.
Like, yeah, like, yeah, like, because he's like, he's about to say dad, but he's just like, Arthur.
Right. Be like, I don't know. I've
and
thought
then,
of some internet jokes I'll keep to myself.
And then we've got Percy comes into the elevator. Percy is still not talking to the family.
Cute. That's, yeah.
It's, and again, to me, Percy's not dumb. Percy's pompous, but Percy's not dumb.
No. I don't really know what his agenda is because, I mean, he's not a Death Eater, right?
As far as we know.
Ah, okay. Whoa. An evil Weasley.
But, and so Percy gets out and, you know, Harry has impersonated someone that really isn't a great fella. Because Arthur's like, one moment, Runcorn. It's like, don't pretend. You tracked down the wizard who faked his family tree, didn't you? Aye, so what if I did? So Dick Cresswell is 10 times the wizard you'll ever be. And if he survives Azkaban, you'll have to answer to him, not to mention his wife, his sons, and his friends. Arthur, Harry interrupted, you know you're being tracked, don't you? Is that a threat, Runcorn? No, said Harry, it's a fact. They're watching your every move.
Do you think Arthur knew this? Does he know this?
Well, you know, it's like probably Arthur highly suspected because that's the natural inclination, but it's another thing to have it like fully like voiced and confirmed.
Yeah.
It's like with the hubby and like knowing that the Revolutionary Guard of Iran and the Islamic Republic is watching his activities and then have it being confirmed when the Revolutionary Guard is shit talking him on their like social media. And again, if you're listening to this because you're desperate and are combing through hours of Harry Potter nerddom for my husband, fuck you, go away.
Hey. I was gonna say something, I forgot.
Yeah. Well, again, one thing to know it and highly suspect it, another thing to confirm it.
Yeah, and I kind of got the impression that Harry was saying that as himself. Like, it was like he was just trying to get the message across and was like, this is my moment, so.
Yeah, because honestly, I think, I can, you know, I don't remember what else happens, but I do remember, I've read a few fanfics, or at least one fanfic a long time ago, where we got to this point in the story, and the writer changed it up, and it's like, Mr. Weasley, it's me, Harry Potter.
Oh, wow. So just blows his own cover. Well, that's...
yeah. And gets, you know, Mr. Weasley to help him do stuff.
Yeah. Oh, well, cool.
If only. So, so they go down into the courtrooms because he wants to try and find Hermione. Oh. And so what's down in the courtrooms? Dementors.
Yeah. That's, I mean, we've been here before, right?
We've been in this vicinity. Like, Harry's trial was in courtroom 10, so the one they're in is not directly courtroom 10, but we're in that vicinity of those creepy ass courtrooms.
Yeah, not a cool place to be because it's basically like pre-Azkaban.
Yeah, this is pre-Azkaban, and there are Dementors. And the sad thing is that Harry is not, despite all of his disguises and stuff, he can't cast a Patronus because everyone's Patronus is so individualized. So if a big stag Patronus starts running through the, like, stampeding over the Dementors, everyone's gonna know it's fucking Harry Potter.
I just saw a TikTok where a guy's Patronus via the Wizarding World website was a salmon. So he's like, I'm a little upset about that. Mine's a beagle. So whatever. Oh,
yeah, no. Well, if Harry had a...
A salmon's not that threatening.
No, I could just see it, like, the salmon Patronus going and just flap, you know, smack him with his tail, the Dementor, like, whack bitch slap here and bitch slap there.
Super fin slapping powers. Maybe that's what it was. I don't know. It was pretty funny. He was not happy about it.
There was one podcast I listened to where, again, one of the co-hosts was unspoiled, and they were a prisoner of Azkaban and, you know, trying to figure out, like, Harry's Patronus and in relation to, like, prongs. And when she heard prongs, like, his Patronus is a lobster.
Oh no. Oh my gosh.
And that became an ongoing, like, reoccurring inside joke of that podcast about a lobster Patronus.
That's, you know, lobster, salmon, sea creatures. That's pretty weird. Yep.
Okay. So this is basically where we have all the Muggleborns coming in for questioning, and we've got one guy screaming, no, I'm half blood. My father was a wizard. He was. Look him up. This is just really sad and depressing and very dark.
Yeah, this is not a fun chapter. Nobody really is super happy here. And obviously the parallels, I'm assuming, to Nazi Germany. And I'm not very, like, if somebody was a half, I don't know how many, like, as far as statistics on, you know, mixed race people, what that was like in Nazi Germany. I don't know. But I'm guessing that those people did not fare very well in Nazi Germany.
Yeah, because there were, whether they knew it or not, but I'm sure there are cases of, like, either direct Nazi officials or Nazi family members where they were, like, you know, their spouses were, like, half whatever. And yeah, so yeah, like, in this sort of system, how much is magical enough? Like, let's say there's someone whose father is a half-blood and their mother is a Muggleborn. What, does that make him a quarter-blood? Is that good enough?
Well,
like, is that...
They have not known about Ancestry.com in the Muggle world, so not yet.
Yeah.
Do they have, like, a spell?
Yeah, like, so how much is it? Is it, how much magical blood is permitted before you're the scum of... before you're considered the scum of Avery Mirth and worthy of extermination in the context of your own race dying out. So you would think
that's
this sort
scary
of
thought, though.
Yeah, because again, there's a sense of you would be that if a society is starting to die out, that you'd get more liberal with those sort of policies. But
yeah,
but, you know.
Now all I can think about is all the people that are worried about, like, their ancestry stuff being submitted and then, you know, somebody getting arrested, which is how they arrested the Golden State Killer. But then, like, somebody getting that information and, you know, being able to be like, you're this. So I don't know.
Yep. And so we come across Umbridge with Yaxley and Hermione's being, like, the sort of, like, you know, record keeper. And so we're in the middle of Mrs. Cattermole's trial. And so there are Dementors here, and there are, and Umbridge's Patronus is like flicking its tail. It's like, obviously it's a big fat cat.
Man, let's lay off the cats, people.
Cats. Like, yeah, we're throwing shade at Pink. We're throwing shade at cats.
Yeah, all the
good,
stereotypically female things.
Yeah, all the good things in life. And so, and it's an interesting notion of, you know, when we'll come up when Harry finally loses his shit and starts stupefying and, like, you know, going into battle mode. You know, there's the idea that Harry's Patronus just stampedes over, like, all the Dementors, that it was so much more powerful than Umbridge's cat. And so first, because the first thing is like, what kind of twisted fuck is Umbridge that her being happy, like, she's deriving happiness out of others' despair, enough so that she can produce a Patronus. So that in itself, the fact that she can even produce one like that, is super twisted and messed up. But it's also speaks, also I was thinking of the more philosophical concept of what does it say that Harry's Patronus is more powerful because its happiness, the happiness origin, is coming from a place of virtue and not twisted sadism.
I'm there's a philosophical, you know, joy and things like that. I just, let me just say it again. Dolores, dominatrix. That was, she would have had quite the Patronus if that was her way. But yeah, as far as joy versus like sadness, I don't know.
Yeah, because honestly, because thinking of that concept of, again, Patronus is being derived from like sadistic, you know, pleasure and like more virtuous joy or protection, it made me think of, you know, all those like pop culture and philosophy book series. So I read the one for Game of Thrones, and it specifically talked about the notion of virtue, like comparing Ned Stark to Cersei Lannister. And the idea is that, yeah, Ned Stark wasn't the smartest, you know, strategist, but ultimately, because he's so virtuous, he was able to live a more fulfilling life. Whereas Cersei, even though she's more of a strategist and is able to survive longer, she can never truly be happy because her like state of being is not based on a place of virtue, and she'll never be happy with herself, no matter how much wealth or power she accumulates.
Huh, that's interesting.
So yeah, so there are some technical terms again for this within philosophy that I'm sure my husband could like break down for me. But yeah, it just reminded me of that, of just like, you know, the power of virtue, like via Patronus literally manifesting itself, that a Patronus made out of virtue is a shit ton more powerful than one that's being conjured out of, you know, twisted Schadenfreude.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like that's a rabbit hole that could be gone down. But
anyway, so yeah. So basically, it's again, this whole thing is a kangaroo court where they're saying, like, this is a wand. Witch or wizard did you steal this wand from? And she's like, I didn't steal it. It's my wand. And she's like, I'm just like, you know, well, let's see, what do we got? You know, I bought it. It's like, no, I don't think so. Mrs. Cattermole, wands only choose witches or wizard. You are not a witch. I have your response to the questionnaire that was sent to you here, Mathilda. Pass them to me. And, so I guess I'm just thinking, like, yes, of course, you know, I'm just, why aren't they giving more of an excuse of, okay, if it is true, if they're peddling this myth that Muggleborns are stealing magic, then how are they doing that? Like, you know, it can be total BS, at least give some reason. But no, it's like, no, we decided that this is the reality we're living in. Not even, you know, giving like, you know, what, you know, giving any sort of parameters.
Yeah, it does not make sense. It's just, I mean, it doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. Choosing, basically, you can be like, I want to be a wizard. And then, oh, cool, we can, or somebody bestows wizard on muggles, or these are all half muggles, right? They're not full muggles.
No, well, again, in terms of their pure blood status, they have no wizarding parents, but they themselves are magical. So again, just in this context, I would think they would be more invested in trying to be like, oh, if they're so like terrible and like bad, then that they're stealing magic, give a little more detail of how that's happening, because you don't want to, you'd be like, oh, these people don't have, if anything, you're making them out to be more powerful than they are.
Yeah.
Anyway, it just, again, and maybe a part of, maybe the point of this sort of story is to just show the absurdity of it, and that they don't offer any story, anything more specific, because if you got into specifics, it could so easily be debunked, and they know that.
Yeah, maybe.
But yeah, it kind of goes into the question of like these people who are, I was thinking about, thinking about what Tucker Carlson and others like that, like those people, the people spewing this crap, do they truly believe it? You know, some of them maybe do, but I think a lot, like Tucker Carlson and others and other politicians, do they genuinely believe it? No, they're just peddling it to advance, you know, to increase, you know, their, you know, the money in their wallets, or to push their political career.
Yeah, I think some of that was recently exposed too at Fox News.
Oh, yeah. Because there was that whole court case of the like lawyer's defense that no reasonable person would take Tucker Carlson seriously, and the judge said, yeah, I agree with that.
Reasonable person.
No reasonable person.
Right. Reason, that's the...
Would take Tucker Carlson at face value, and the judge is like, yep, you're right.
Yeah. The problem is not the reasonable people, though, as we saw with Donald Trump.
Indeed. So, and in all of this, you know, Harry was pilfering through Umbridge's office, but Umbridge is actually wearing the locket in question.
Yeah.
And she's wearing it because she is trying to bolster her own family status by passing it off like the S stands for Slughorn. I am related to the Slughorns. Indeed, there are a few pure blood families to whom I am not related. So, again, so she's just using this as her own means to protect herself in this sort of specific regime. And this just really sends Harry over the edge.
I don't blame him. That's just stupid. Stupid, stupid, stupid.
Yeah, it was Umbridge's lie that brought the blood. So, you know, obviously this is kind of played off about, this is kind of played off, you know, as, you know, obviously the injustice of, you know, Harry was forced to write, I must not tell lies, and the very person who did that is telling such a blatant lie. So there, you know, and Harry's personality does, like, support that it's purely just normal psychological triggering and things like that, but I just came to my head right now, like, is it possible that there's some sort of magical residue of that quill and having to write that, and that there's some sort of magic behind that sentiment that Harry cannot handle liars?
Maybe that's interesting. I wonder though, would she have, like, I don't know. I'll have to think about it.
Yep. And so Harry loses his shit and says stupefy, and Umbridge's crumples and her forehead hits the edge of the counter.
Boom. Good. Go away.
Good. And then stupefies Yaxley.
Why not? Let's stupefy everybody.
They're stupefying everyone. Dementors have realized that all hell is break loose. Is like, oh, I can suck whatever souls I want now. Harry casts his Patronus. And he's telling Hermione, move your butt. But she's like, I have to duplicate it. Otherwise, we can't let it show that it's missing. Because Hermione's the smart one.
Yeah, right. But she cannot produce a Patronus, right? It's the only thing she can't do.
Yeah, she cannot do it. But it's okay, because we've got Harry and his stag. And then, yeah, it's the only spell she's ever had trouble with, Harry told. Unfortunate.
And she gives him so much shit for the occlumency, and she can't do the damn Patronus.
Yeah, and you know, this is underlined in the fact that when they got their OWL results at the beginning of book 6, like, Harry got the outstanding, the highest grade, and Hermione, her only exceeds expectations, her only second best grade was Defense Against the Dark Arts. So they, like, you know, so it's set up, I don't think it's just... It's just, you know, the Patronus, you know, and Hermione. Yeah, they're just always played it off that Harry's just really good at, like, this sort of directly defensive magic.
Is it the kind of, like, can't have the rainbow without the rain kind of situation? Like, he's experienced extreme pain, so he can conjure something the opposite? I don't know.
I don't know, but I think there's something to be said that, well, first of all, he had such specialized training from Lupin. And also the sense that specifically that Lupin, like, he didn't realize till later, the fact that he has more than just a more like mentee relationship with Lupin. The fact that one of his, like, dad's best friend taught him. I think there's a lot of positive emotion in not just learning the Patronus as a functional, useful tool, but there's a lot of emotion and good memories of, oh, one of my father's best friends taught me this.
I have a theory about Hermione's Patronus.
Do you want to save it for, like, the end of the chapters, or?
Oh, I just think that she'll be able to produce a Patronus once her and Ron get together. Because she'll finally be happy.
Finally be happy.
That's very romance reader of me, so.
Anyway. Oh, yes, because you don't need someone to complete you. You only need someone to compliment you.
Yes, exactly.
Anyway, so, yeah, Silver Otter finally bursts through.
Silver Otter.
So basically they're breaking out all the Muggleborns, and then the Ministry already realizes that there must be intruders, because Harry, in his noble prattness, took Mad-Eye's eye, and from the eye being missing, they know something is wrong.
Oh, yeah.
So that was, you know, again, I don't directly remember this in previous readings, but I feel like that's one of the few instances of, it's like, Harry, stop being Ned Stark. Be a little bit of a Slytherin.
Okay, by the way, I've had a long day. I say that all the time. So Hermione eventually did produce the otter Patronus. Okay. Okay. But anyway, so sorry about that, even though maybe it'll shoot out faster once she and Ron make out or fall in love. Yeah. But anyway, back to our regularly scheduled programming here.
But yeah, so that was one of my first things of like, Harry, like, you can't take the eye, like, any little detail. Like,
Yeah.
Which, again, trying to remind myself, you know, because that's one of the themes, again, if I ever write my goddamn saga of Harry HP fanfic, like, one of the themes is that you need both people. You need the Ned Starks in the world to, like, you know, call bullshit as they see it, but you also need the Lord Varys's to be able to mitigate and do damage control behind the scenes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's some diabolical people in the world, so.
Yeah. And so, yeah, lots of action, you know, Yaxley comes around chasing them, gripping them, and then they finally able to escape. They see the door of Grimmauld Place, but then Hermione is like suddenly grabs them and everything goes dark again. And then pshoo, we're in chapter 14 and we're in the middle of a forest.
And Ron has some issues with the disapparating.
Yeah. Harry opens his eyes and they're in a forest. And at first he's like, is it Forbidden Forest? Are we at Hogwarts? And is like really happy for a second. Mm-hmm. He's like, let's go to Hagrid's hut and have some rock cakes and a cup of tea.
Yeah, Harry.
The whole shebang? Have you learned
nothing? Yes.
You know nothing, Harry Potter.
Yeah, exactly.
But it is not the Forbidden Forest. He realizes the trees are too thin, they're too young, they're too, you know, widespread. And Hermione is tending to Ron, which basically, yeah, Ron has been splinched. And Harry watched horrified, you know, because, you know, when they were learning apparition, like in the school, there's that whole comic relief of Susan Bones, like, splinches herself by, like, losing a leg. But it's not shown as being, like, agonizing, like, amputating, that it's just considered, like, funny. And they immediately, like, in a puff of smoke, she's, like, you know, rejoined again. But this is, like, someone has just taken, you know, an axe to Ron's arm and just cut it off.
Yeah. Sounds pretty not fun.
Yep. And... yep, Hermione is able to mostly heal it, but doesn't fully because she's scared she'll screw it up. So it's going to make, you know, Ron kind of heal the old-fashioned way a little bit.
Oh, man. Yeah.
And Harry's like, I saw Grimmauld Place, why weren't we going? And Hermione's like really upset. She's like, Harry, Yaxley was a hold of me when we were at Grimmauld Place. I apparated him within the border of the Fidelis Charm. They now have access to Grimmauld Place. We can't go back.
Ooh. Dun, dun, dun.
What did you think of this development?
I guess I didn't really know that, like, or maybe I had forgotten that, like, that could equate access to places. Just, like,
yeah, because they did explain it in earlier chapters that, you know, by Dumbledore dying, anyone that Dumbledore told the secret to can now give the secret of Grimmauld Place. Too, and by Hermione apparating with Yaxley holding her, even though it wasn't her intent, that in essence is quote-unquote giving Yaxley permission to enter.
Whoops, that's pretty much bad news.
Yep. And then...
but I mean, the only person that's at Grimmauld Place, sorry, right now is, well, in person, creature, right?
Yeah, so it's not like someone else is there is in an imminent danger, but it's just a big blow to the fact that that was their home base, like that they were sure that they weren't out in the open, like literally that's the place they went because literally they had nowhere else to go because Death Eaters found them so quickly when they were in public in Muggle London.
Okay, either way it's bad news, but yeah. I'm just either way, nobody's in imminent danger except creature.
Yeah. And Harry's just like, you know, I'm and like, and we learn later in the chapter, like, they go back and forth. It's like, we can't summon creature because he may be being watched.
Bad news. Which,
quite frankly, my understanding of elvish magic, I think it wouldn't be a threat to summon creature. Like, I think creature could, like, shake any wizard trying to hold him because he's privy to elf magic, and the magic of obeying your master supersedes all other people's, you know, all other wizarding magic. So, like, honestly, again, they're playing it safe, but from what all I understand of being a crazy Potterhead for 10 plus years, I think it would have been safe to summon creature, but they don't.
Hmm. Well, I like your theory that they're more powerful than actual wizards. So.
Well, yeah. Well, I told you, that's my whole theory of that's why they were enslaved, because they realized very early, oh, you know, these creatures are more powerful than art. We need to condition them to be psychologically dependent on us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Same with women. They, you know, men realize that they let themselves be too heavily influenced by a certain appendage. And yeah, therefore, to neutralize that threat of influence, they need to, you know, make women second-class citizens.
Yep, I wholeheartedly believe that. So we used to be amazing, and now men were assholes, and still.
Yeah, all anyway. And again, it always happens in quote-unquote more civilized societies, because all the barbarian tribes, like, women had more power. And women were wielding swords, and women were wielding axes, like all those Visigoths and Ostrogoths and the Celts. Like, women had it hell of a lot better.
That, yeah. One day.
Yeah. All right. And so, yeah. So Hermione immediately goes to put protective charms around the area. They're building the tent, and it's the same tent that they used for the Quidditch World Cup.
Lovely throwback there.
Lovely throwback. And so again, it is literally like a little apartment.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, what book was that? Three?
Four.
Four.
Beginning of four, you know, Quidditch World Cup before the shit happened with the Dark Mark.
Right.
When you first started to realize things were going too well and what's going to blow up.
Right. Exactly.
Alrighty. Yeah.
This is just kind of keep going down and down though right now. So.
Yep. We're going down and down and... Yep, and then Ron is like, don't say the name, and they have this sort of ideological battle about the merits of saying or not saying Voldemort's name.
Yeah.
Because Ron says something like, just show you know who some respect, will you? And Harry's like, respect?
Yeah. Come on. I'm with Dumbledore on this. Like,
it's... Yeah, I guess the only thing I'm thinking of is, like, when you're making fun of Hitler and trying to, you know, in terms of having comedy about the Nazis and comedy about Hitler, it's the question of, like, Mel Brooks's, you know, stance on the matter is that when you make fun of Hitler, you're taking away his post-mortis power by showing, like, how absurd his and the Nazi ideology was, you know. And yeah. Then there are the other people, you know, there's the other side of the spectrum that think if you're making fun of him, you're making fun of, you know, 6 million people murdered.
I guess that's why a lot of Germans just don't really talk about it, right?
Yeah, so if anything, I feel like, you know, Harry and Hermione and Dumbledore have the stance of, you know, you're robbing him of his power if you say his name. Whereas I think Ron is not directly wanting to show respect to Voldemort himself. I think he's taking more of the approach of, this is a huge threat and a lot of people have been impacted by this person, showing respect to the severity of the situation, not the person.
I mean, I guess I can see that side too. I don't know. I was thinking about words. I'm thinking about words. Very different.
What's in a name? A rose by any other would smell just as sweet.
Exactly.
Which I am gonna go see Romeo and Juliet later this year.
Oh yeah,
yeah. When I go visit my family, like my hometown's known for the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and the only two Shakespeare plays that they're showing for this season is Romeo and Juliet and Twelfth Night. So I'm gonna make my husband sit through Romeo and Juliet because I have not seen it on stage actually.
Oh, have I? I don't remember. I don't think I did. They have Shakespeare in the Park here. I saw something. I don't remember what it was. Obviously, it was very memorable.
Yeah, it was so memorable. Like, I like my Shakespeare in the Park, in at least where I am. It was Henry IV, Part One, which again is a not lesser known history, but still is pretty good.
Yeah,
yeah. So, and of course, very British. Hermione's like, I'll make some tea because tea makes everything better. Which, again, for me, who has been like staying home from work the past 2 days, just drinking tea and eating cookies. Yeah, tea makes things better.
Yeah.
Especially when paired with a cat on your lap and a book.
Yeah, it's a pretty ideal situation. Absolutely.
There's There's one advertisement that keeps coming through my news feed. It's like, it's the it's a t-shirt that says, "That's what I do. I pet cats, I read books, and I know things."
Oh,
you know, playing off the "I drink wine and I know things."
Yes, yeah. What was his name? Peter Dinklage.
Yeah.
What's his name in the show?
Tyrion Lannister.
Tyrion Lannister. God, I'm better with.
Have you watched Hot D yet?
No, not yet. No.
Go watch.
We're almost done with Atlanta, and then yeah.
Priorities, man.
Atlanta's a good show. It's darker than it's got its own Southern Gothicness to it. It's pretty cool.
Indeed. And so, yeah, so they're figuring this all out. And then Ron's a little slow on the update because they never told him, we actually got the locket.
Yeah. That's all right.
And, you know, Ron's, you know, vainly hoping, he's like, maybe it's already destroyed and we don't have to deal with it. But Harry can kind of see it's kind of described as a sort of metallic, like clicking, like heartbeat.
Ugh, that's creepy.
Yeah, because in a sense, it's kind of alive in the same way that the diary was alive.
Yeah, well, because it's a bit of his, like, soul, so.
Yeah, and Harry's just like, I think creature's right. We're going to have to work out how to open it before we can destroy it.
Yeah, because that's something they just cannot figure out, how to destroy it.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing. It's like they went through this whole upheaval and like Harry's thinking that they should have more sense of triumph, but it's like they've just been going and it's like, okay, we have it and we have no means to destroy it.
Yeah. I think I have what do you, if they get them all, because if they're like, are they Pokemon, you collect them all and then like, what do you do? Like when he has, I'm assuming he can't just like sit on them once they... I don't know. I have a lot of questions.
Like, what do you mean sit on them? Yeah, well, because obviously...
Like, if they have all the Horcruxes, doesn't that kind of, like, conjure something more powerful?
Does it?
Okay. So I'm on the right track is what I'm getting. But, all right.
Yep. And then, so, what we got?
Harry's dreaming.
Yeah, I'm just trying to double check that there's nothing specific. No, there's nothing really more specific, before the dream. So yeah, except that, you know, Hermione scavenged some mushrooms and apparently they were really shitty and Harry just scarfs them down so not to hurt her feelings. And it's like,
good woman getting food for the men there, Hermione.
Yeah, and it's like, yeah. And just whole not sparing Hermione her feelings. It's like, did I see you? Looking at the scavenging for mushrooms. Did I see you like hunting a hare or like shooting down a bird?
Let me give you some advice, men. Just shut the fuck up. If you didn't cook it, just eat it and move on. Don't be a bitch.
Yeah.
I'm a fun person to live with, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Well, I like super salty things. And like, to me, a normal amount of salt is like, it's too salty. And I'm just like, and then I'll be like, it's not seasoned. And I'm like, because you don't trust my discretion with the salt, baby.
That's, thankfully. Yeah. Anyway, cooking adventures. Yeah.
Although to be fair, my husband like cooked before I did and kind of taught me how to cook, but still.
That is not the case with me. I am the cook.
Yeah, the kitchen for a long time was purely my husband's domain, and then I joined in later.
Damn. I need some of my husband to make it his domain for a while. Just for a while.
Yep. And so, and then we get, again, mushroom-induced dream.
Whoa. Not like the cool, fun kind of dream, though.
No.
Scary.
We've got Voldemort torturing Gregorovich, the foreign, like, Slavic wand maker. And it's like, I have it not. I have it no more. It was many years ago, stolen from me. Do not lie to Lord Voldemort, Gregorovich. He knows. He always knows. And it's just like, okay, little Tom is severely triggered by lying. And he like, lost his shit in front of Dumbledore when he was, and as we learn, when he invades Gregorovich's mind, it's like, yeah, he was telling the truth. He was, the thing, whatever he was looking for, was stolen from him. And he sees the image of the thief, like, running off into the night with their, like, little smirk on their face.
Yeah.
So it's like, so yeah, so it's just so dramatic. So do not lie. He knows. He always knows. And even Dumbledore, when he went goes to get little Tom at the orphanage, he's telling the truth. And little Tom is just like, don't lie to me. You're from the asylum. Tell the truth. So like, I'm just curious, like who lied to him?
Yeah. What happened? Why is it such a...
Like what? Again, with all of his like... All of his other sociopathy, he has all this proclivity for nature versus nurture. Like this specifically, I feel like what specifically happened, who lied to him, and why were the consequences so severe that that is like such, he's so paranoid about lying, which is why he's invested so much in like mastering legitimacy.
Right. That's a good question. I'm trying to think of like, I don't know. It's probably like it's who lied to him. I mean... Or is he just a liar himself?
Well, they also could just be pure projection because he lies so much and therefore he thinks everyone is shitty as him.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
But anyway, so because, well, again, he's such a drama queen that he like, he's so paranoid of being made a fool of and not being the best. So he needs to always know exactly what's going on. But
anyway, I guess I can relate to Voldemort.
Anyways, so just taking note of, wow, like, huge trigger for little Tommy is, you know, lying. And again, Gregorovitch wasn't lying. It was stolen from him and didn't even... And ends up killing Gregorovitch, it seems.
Nice. That's what you gotta do. Just kill the problem. Don't deal with it.
Yeah, and again, Hermione is such a...
I would be like, why did it take you so long to produce that damn Patronus, Hermione?
Yeah. And people always say when it comes to relationships and friendships, you shouldn't throw around whataboutism, but.
Well, yeah, but whatever. I'm annoyed with her little flying over it. I don't know.
Yeah, so it's, I didn't mean it. If you had just learned, especially it's one thing to say that, oh, Dumbledore took time out of his busy schedule fighting a war to teach you occlumency and still you can't do it. It would be one thing if Dumbledore had taught him, or even if Lupin had taught someone decent had taught him. But the specific context of Snape taught him and where Snape's allegiances lie, you know.
I mean,
and still Hermione is harping on that it's all Harry's fault, that Harry let his personal grievances with Snape get in the way when it was quite the opposite.
Does she think Snape is so altruistic when it comes to teaching that he may not have, like, that he just taught him, like, he didn't, like, mess with it? Basically, like, what makes her think that Snape is of such high caliber of an educator that he actually taught him correctly? Why didn't that ever cross her mind? Like, maybe he didn't.
Yeah.
Maybe he fucked with it a little bit.
And, you know, it's written, Harry Potter, you know, Harry decides he never tells Ron and Hermione why the occlumency lesson stopped. They stopped because he saw that memory. And so I wonder if Harry had been honest with Hermione, he saw this and quit giving me lessons, then Hermione would have more ability to understand that, okay, this adult is a very flawed individual and is letting their emotions and their hubris get in the way of what Dumbledore told him to do, and maybe from that would not be harping on Harry in this way if she knew about the whole memory interaction, but she doesn't know that.
I feel like she tends to put professors on a pedestal when they don't always necessarily belong there.
Well, and even Ron says that to her, like in book 6 when they're like debating about Snape.
Yeah. I guess sometimes that didn't change her mind. But
yeah, because again, despite of all the things, you know, she is evolving in terms of, again, her very gangster sense of justice and vigilante justice in a lot of ways towards certain people like Marietta Edgecombe and others. But still, she's at least a part of her is still holding on to this very like law notion of lawful good where the people in authority have to be respected and obeyed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and Hermione's just so snippy. It's like, I think I'd better take over the watch. If you're so tired, you're falling asleep, said Hermione coldly. And it's like, I just want to give her the middle finger.
Yeah, what a pill.
Yep, and so since he doesn't want to have a row with Hermione about it, so Harry confides in Ron about the whole thing with Gregorovitch. And, you know, they're speculating, like, well, I thought the whole point was to get a wand maker to, like, try and figure out the thing going on with your wands and why just getting a different wand isn't working. But it's not like it doesn't look as if he wanted Gregorovich to make him a new wand. Like, what is he after that he was so willing to just kill a probably very knowledgeable wand maker?
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know, said Harry slowly. Maybe, but wouldn't it be dangerous for him to make another one? Did Hermione say he had pushed... Oh, like, here Ron is theorizing that, you know, he wants something that Gregorovich had and it was stolen. And Ron makes a very interesting argument of, do you think there's another object he wants to make into another Horcrux? And Harry's like, I don't know, but wouldn't it be dangerous for him to make another one? Didn't Hermione say he had pushed his soul to the limit already? Yeah, but maybe he doesn't know that.
How would he not know that, though? Yeah. I also think, like, he's probably egotistical enough that he's like, yeah, but I'm special. Like,
yeah, I'm the king shit of fuck mountain. So, again, right, exactly. Interesting, you know, Ron is not stupid. Ron be throwing down some valid points.
Yeah. Yeah, I tell you, it's that book on the romance book. It did everything.
Yeah, the failed 12 fail sage ways charm witches.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yep. And thus, that is the end of the chapter. And again, reading no more until next week.
No.
Alrighty then.
Swiping past the Harry Potter game. TikTok.
Oh yeah, again. After the whole that video essay about, you know, that, you know, she who must not be named versus that trans YouTuber, I was just like, yeah, I really don't want to support the game.
Yeah.
And there is some I think they did add a trans character into the game, but people are criticizing that as being a last minute bit of tokenism, and even the voice actor of that character has apologized for their involvement in it.
Wow. I didn't know about that. I saw somewhere that they thought they had an image of J.K. Rowling burning at the stake, but that's what I've heard. Yeah. I don't know. It kind of looks like her, but...
That's again, reiterating, that's why I enjoy my biggest forays into Harry Potter fandom are fan fiction and podcasting, the two things that She Who Must Not Be Named gets no benefit from. Although, like, I wish there was a way for, like, Harry the writer to, like, sever his, like, partnership with her so that all his so that she doesn't get his royalties anymore and it just all goes back to him.
Yeah. One day.
Maybe, who knows? Maybe there's a court case going on right now between Harry Potter and She Who Must Not Be Named in the wizard gamut.
There's another fan fiction. Somebody could write the rights of the Harry Potter book between
Harry Potter versus J.K. Rowling.
J.K. Rowling. Well, yeah, why not? It might be fun.
Indeed. Don't give me ideas now.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do.
Alrighty then. So let us begin our exercises with Gothic Geek Out.
Gothic Geek Out. You know, I think, again, since I like to concentrate on the more morbid aspects when I can.
Which is, again, ironic because you love romance so much and yet you diverge with me with Gothic romance and you wanting Gothic horror.
I think it's just like you got to have a balance. I'm very much, there's, I don't know, polarity of things, but... I don't really know, actually, if this falls into the any sort of Gothic trope, but I did like the fact that Umbridge does kind of have a trophy from, you know, she didn't actually, I guess maybe a serial killer aficionado would tell me I'm wrong because it's not technically a trophy because she didn't technically kill him, but I don't know. I thought that was
the fact that she has a treatment from a fallen person on the other side.
Yeah, which, you know, I think of in different wars, soldiers kind of stealing different things from, you know, down soldiers. I'm trying to be sensitive here, but I know my grandfather, like, had a sword from somebody in the Korean War that was not from an American soldier. So things like that, too. That's not necessarily a Gothic trope or anything, but we could also kind of associate that with cursed objects and, you know, I don't know.
No, that's an interesting one because, yeah, because it's used a lot. I'm sure there have been studies on this. Like, what, even if when it's not like in a creepy serial killer way, the fact that we attach memories to objects in such a way.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's
like that is basically the whole reason why our materialistic capitalist society works, is that we assign psychological and sentimental value to otherwise, you know, worthless objects.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I assigned, you know, sentimental value to a bunch of pages and ink because, you know, that I created into a book.
Yeah. I mean, I think we all have that thing that we won't throw away because it reminds us of somebody, a cat. I don't know. I have some things like that that I have. But I don't know. With just kind of, you know, maybe I could say even Dolores Umbridge is like the queen of the goth in this series, because though she wears a lot of pink, she is
in her element with. With Addison Kane on her throne of bones, drinking the blood of her enemies from a skull.
That's, I mean, I don't want to say anything about that because I don't want to be depicted anywhere by this person. So, yeah. What about you? What was your gothicness this week?
Again, to me, just the pure horror element of obviously this was written for children, and you know the series has gone dark in a lot of ways. But I think it's a certain category and degree of darkness when you're depicting the systematic removal and possible extermination of a whole marginalized group.
Mm-hmm.
And so seeing that, you know, happen right before Harry's eyes, of people like crying and saying like, no, I'm not part of this group. I'm part of mainstream society, and being dragged away, like that's a level of, you know, darkness and gothicness.
I'm trying to think of, I mean, sure other children's books have dealt with that, but
yeah,
I don't know.
Oh no, you said children's books, and I'm talking about that, and then of course all the book bans on Mouse.
Oh yeah, Mouse. Okay. Yeah, that's Mouse. I was thinking predating Harry Potter, but I couldn't think. I mean, I guess Animal Farm, but that's not really a kid's book. I don't know.
I read it as a freshman in high school, so I don't know. What do you call a kid's book for high school?
I guess that's the thing with Harry Potter, it's kind of grew with its audience. So like, yeah, the book, and that's, one is,
you know, and that's, and like that's the only sort of censorship I kind of sort of understand, like for like parents who, because now all the books are published and, you know, we're not waiting years between books and the kids are growing up with it. Like, I could understand if a parent was like, okay, you can only read the first three books for now, you know, and then moving on when they get older. Like, that is the only form of Harry Potter, like, censorship versus, like, age appropriateness that I can kind of sort of get behind. Everything else is bullshit.
Yeah, and in that, that's, like, kind of a little bit more intimate censorship, too. You kind of know what your kid can and can't, like, deal with. So that makes more sense to me.
Yeah, and it's not the school's job to be a little bubble. It's like, if you don't want them to read that book, then have a good enough conversation with your kids so that they show you what they're bringing home from school in their backpack.
Yeah, because they might. That's
what pisses me off so much about these sort of like book bans and all this stuff. They want basically the school to parent. Like, to me, that's a level of parenting. It's like, you don't want to do your job anymore. And so, okay, if you don't want to do your job anymore, fine. But then you don't get to complain that there are cultural influences you don't like.
I think that's totally fair.
Yeah. Anyway, again, I bitch enough about the book bans on this podcast, but as a literary podcast, but I'll shut up now. So, okay. So we can move on to Tarot of the Day. And I did not pick a sword this time.
Whoa.
Be still my heart. I did pick another knight, the Knight of Pentacles.
Okay. Knight of Pentacles.
Yeah, Knight of Pentacles. like the knights of other suits, represents work, effort, and the responsibility that follows upon the dreams and ideals of the page. The knight is the most hardworking. When this card appears in a tarot reading, you are working methodically towards your goals. You have a plan in place and are sticking to your schedule to get the job done. You may not work particularly quickly, but you are consistent, dedicated, and committed to your goal. Put one foot in front of the other and finish the job. The card also asks you to continue to doing what you're doing, plodding along and making gradual progress. Which, if anything, I feel like the sentiment of this card is, like, from the previous chapters, like, because they were building up so much, like, weeks and weeks to, like, prep for the infiltration of the ministry, and then it just happened.
Yeah, so I guess this is kind of the, what is the execution of that plan?
The execution of that plan, and then, the only thing I think of is, again, like, getting, like, just trying to stay focused for the long haul, and, you know, that sentiment comes in the fact that they have the Horcrux, but they have no means to destroy it.
Right, so they've got their, like, they're halfway there. They've got the thing, but they don't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes the Knight of Pentacles points to the most mundane or boring aspects of life, the daily grind, repetitive schedules, household chores, and other responsibilities and obligations. You may be assigned a project or given a task to do, and you will have to commit your time to see that project through to the end successfully. With the Knight of Pentacles, you will be required to accept responsibility without any complaints or grudges. If anything, I think, again, for future chapters, what we see in 14, whereof now they're in a setting of, like, camping and, like, really basic survival stuff.
And so
they're gonna start to get into that sort of routine, because again, now they don't have the home base of Grimmauld Place. And again, Harry and Ron, you can go find the mushrooms next time,
or, like, magic them up. I don't know, is that stuff tracked?
Well, can no, they do that, like, to make it so that wizards can't just immediately conjure food, like, that is technically not allowed according to various magical law. Not like legal laws, like, just the science of magic. Like, you cannot conjure a bowl of spaghetti.
Dang.
Like, you still, like you can tell, like, the pot and the pan to, like, stir things and pour things or cut things, but you cannot just summon a potato into, you cannot create a potato from non-being into being. Your face.
Okay. Like, oh, well, I'm thinking about this because I guess, like, I'm thinking about, like, when they're at Hogwarts. And then it's like, and all but this the food elves, comes up. The elves that's are been prepared by the elves.
Yeah. and it's being magically transported, but that isn't from the kitchens. But yeah, that food is not just coming into being.
So it's just, substituting the person or the, like, action. It's not the organic matter that's being.
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay.
So they do have to think about, like, the hard nitty gritties of, you know, getting food, like scavenging mushrooms, which Ron and Harry, you can take a crack at it.
Yeah, come on. Did you read any cookbooks? You know what to do.
Yeah. And you would think Ron, of being, you know, being the offspring of Molly Weasley, would fucking know at least a few recipes.
Yeah, or at least how to be, like, resourceful in a difficult situation, because, again, they grew up without money, so.
Yeah, so you would think he also, but, and that's the sad thing about, like, me not, again, feeling sorry for Weasley, Mrs. Weasley, but at the same time not, and it's like, why did you allow your sons to skate off like this? You have six of them, and you let them cave into the patriarchal bullshit, instead of being like, no, you're going to wash the dishes with me.
Do better, Molly Weasley.
Again, because she probably had magic to help a good chunk of it, so she didn't need to shove that onto the kids, possibly, in terms of just basic chores.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's all. Anything more do you have for the Knight of Pentacles? That's all I've got.
No, I really don't. Nine of Pentacles, Knight of Taurus.
Swords or
Taurus? Swords. I always think of Taurus when we think of pentacles, because it's earthly. Like,
oh yeah, goods. This is true. I did not pull out the Taurus card in my of the Oracle cards. I did pick out the zodiac before it, which is Aries.
Oh, Aries. It's one I don't know a lot about.
A sign that I do not traditionally get along with.
I must not either, because I cannot tell you a single Aries that I'm
which is, like, ironic because again, Lacey, who's been on this show, she's an Aries. I'm step
oh
I'm stemming my experience from my one, like, childhood, I considered her my best friend, and then in eighth grade she decided she hated my guts.
Oops.
And did a lot of catty things. And to be fair, I did some catty things back, but I claim the defensive, retaliatory, position that I didn't start it, she did. So, so Aries. And Harry's, sun sign is Leo, but his moon sign is Aries.
Oh.
So Aries is kind of more of Harry's emotional state. Hmm. Anyway, so, Aries people are highly ambitious and want to accomplish things quickly and in a no-nonsense way. Competition is what Aries is all about. Many feel the need to compete when the other party doesn't even care to. Traditionally, Aries is a warrior sign, which means always being on the defensive, ready for action. The Aries style of relating is that of a catalyst using force, not of a peacemaker. They're interested in sports. A number of Arians have a fascination with weapons. Well, Harry was appealing to some of his Aries tendencies when he's like, that's it, I'm over this, and just stuns Umbridge and just lets all hell break loose.
That is, I guess, the weapon. I was going to say, because it's quite the opposite of all the other characters I can think about, like ambitious, all of these people are not really going after ambition, but just like doing the work. Like, I was going to say, oh, well, Voldemort is kind of, but he wants the drama. So he's not just like doing the work. He's like, yeah. Oh, I've got to do it and with then, a flair.
And well, this makes me think of Hermione. Aries people are highly ambitious and want to accomplish things quickly in a no-nonsense way.
Yeah, that's
so Hermione. Like, I would not be surprised if, maybe not her moon sign, because obviously, well, no, because she's a double Virgo, sun and moon. Like, I could see Hermione's rising sign to be Aries, because it's that part of her personality, which is very pushy and, like, and such a know-it-all to the point that, she pushes people away sometimes. And her being so like one track mind about occlumency and not thinking about all the nuances, she's like, because basically she's telling Harry, just shut up and do it,
Yeah.
And she's like, I don't want to hear any excuses. But yeah, that can kind of be sort of very Aries energy.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. You will work best in situations where you make your own decisions rather than acting as an underling. You may even find a supporting cast to help you finish your work. Be responsible and disciplined in all of your actions. You will want to get things started and forge ahead. Do not buckle under the drama or trivialities of others. This is interesting, situation work best when you can make your own decisions rather than acting as an underling. That kind of triggers me thinking about the whole dynamic between the Golden Trio.
Mm.
Which, by the way, the latest episode of Fox and the Foxhound, go check it out, is all about like the Golden Trio and their dynamics.
Oh,
so go check that out if that interests you specifically.
All right.
But yeah, because definitely, obviously, if anything, because not enough is done with Ron to like, where he becomes the leader in any capacity. But in essence, because the Golden Trio basically flips between Harry being the leader and Hermione being the leader.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And, yeah, it does. He's never takes the lead.
He only takes the lead, like, again, when there's direct action, at hand, because he's the hero and whatever. And again, because it's everyday life, he expects a woman to take care of him, which can just shut up and say, thank you, Hermione, for making that homework planner for me.
Yeah. Thanks for going and finding mushrooms.
Thanks for making sure I didn't die from Fluffy in the first year.
Thanks for everything, Hermione. That's there's another story that we can tell.
Yeah. Well, someone wrote a whole fan fiction that's purely canon compliant, like all the books, just from Hermione's perspective.
Oh, wow. Oh my gosh, what an undertaking.
It was, yeah. I don't know which book they're on now, but it's they've been going at it for a few years. I haven't read it, but yeah, I always hear about it from time to time.
Wow. Well, good for them. That sounds like a lot of work.
Indeed. Alrighty then. Anything more you want to say about Aries energy in these chapters?
Aries energy, not really. I respect Aries energy more than I thought. That's what I would say.
At least you don't hate them as much as Capricorns.
Well, Capricorns are my opposite, and I feel very strongly about them. Yes.
Yeah. Because, well, do I hate Scorpios? Well, it's just, for me, my experience with Scorpios is very gendered. because with all my distaste being towards Scorpio men and like being fine with Scorpio women. But for me, Aries is more like balanced gender wise, where I've just not always had, you know, I've more consistently not had great experiences with Aries on with both genders.
Yeah. I can't think of a single Aries. But Scorpios, I like Scorpios.
Yeah. So. Alrighty then. And then we move on to our final exercise. Fan fiction time.
Well, I really liked the idea of Umbridge having a kid. And let's just say it was Harry's age. Mm-hmm. Like maybe she has a love child that we don't know about that was in Hogwarts. And that is why she's so nasty to Harry.
Because the kid is mean to Harry and have their own rivalry, or because like the kid is jealous of Harry, like give me that.
She's like taking it out on Harry because there's like, you know, I think that there are always, I feel like I just watched a movie about this. It's like the person, what was that movie called? Anyway, it was a school shooting thing movie. I can see the cover. Anyway, you know, the kids were like pretty chill with everybody, but in the background they were planning like to shoot up the school because they were, you know, kind of seething underneath it all. What if Dolores had like a kid like that? We don't know anything about it, but you know, she's kind of retaliating and against Harry because of that, you know, she's like defending her son, but it's kind of an unspoken thing.
Yeah.
I don't know who would be her kid.
Yeah. I'm thinking of what if she has a child who is a squib.
Okay.
Oh, who in essence is like a muggle and trying to navigate this system and taking her anger out on Harry as a half blood.
I just feel like Dolores could very much be like, that should have been my child. So I'm going to like, you know, take out all my anger on that. Not that there's any sort of logic or whatever behind it, but she could just be like, that should have been mine and it's not. Yeah. So I'm going to.
Yeah. You know. Oh my God. Umbridge would be one of these parents waging the culture wars.
Yeah, she would. Yeah. She's evil.
Yeah. Well, again, she did all the damage she did when she didn't have kids. Imagine if she did have a kid. And
like, what if she just had a kid and she was like, I don't want it, and gave it up for adoption. But I guess they wouldn't have that line of communication. I don't know. I just think it's interesting if Dumbledore. God, I'm obsessed with Dumbledore. Dolores Umbridge had a kid.
Interesting. Ooh. If anyone knows of that fan fiction, send it to me. I'm curious.
Yeah, I am too.
Mine was far less imaginative and far less outward reaching. What if Grimmauld Place had not been compromised?
So then they wouldn't have to be out foraging for mushrooms and things like that.
Yeah, so they wouldn't, and Ron wouldn't have been splinched because I think the idea is that, you know, Hermione quickly apparated again and could barely hang on to Harry and Ron because she was trying to get rid of Yaxley. So I think the idea is that like Yaxley wasn't attached to them, and so they just apparate like normal back to Grimmauld Place and are back in their safe zone. Well, first of all, they'd be having their steak and kidney pudding made by Creature, and not rubbery mushrooms.
Not rubbery mushrooms that we have to like.
I have not talked about mushrooms this much since Mexican Gothic.
Yeah, why did you bring that up? Now I'm totally jarred. Yeah, well, they probably would have had an easier state, but okay. It's protected, right? By the magic. So the ministry can't.
No, like the ministry of the Death Eaters, like, yeah, if you actually was not a problem and wasn't grabbed on Hermione. Yeah. It's protected. Like no one can get in there.
Okay.
That they don't.
So they could have. Yeah. Been fine.
Yeah, so they could have been fine. They still would have had the issue of not knowing how to destroy the locket and still having crazy dreams of what is the deal with Grigorovich, lots of other things. But at least, you know, things would look far less bleak because, again, they could still have access to, like, food and, like, not constantly, like, having to spend energy keeping watch, so being able to sleep normally.
Hmm.
which is why I get so mad of people, you know, throwing shade at like tiny house communities that are like trying, or like temporary housing, like not in my backyard to help homeless people. And it's just like, you want the homeless, you know, crisis to stop. You need to house them first because they need a place to sleep and function before they can tackle these issues in their life, because you can't do anything when they're constantly in survival mode.
Yeah. Why don't people, that only makes sense, but people are cold and stupid and mean, and they just don't think about those things. Or if they've never just experienced any discomfort in their life and they can't think that through. People.
I was, you know, I had a pretty cushy, and still I can think of that. I can still think of that, of just, you need to sleep to function.
Because you're a reader and you're an empathetic person. And also, and you're also not an idiot. You're a smart person. So those things, I feel like a lot of people, they just are like, my thread count is less tonight. Oh my God, what a tragedy. Homeless person, get a job.
You just said that and you made me think of that like meme or like that clip with the Kardashians. And it's like, I lost my ring in the water. And she's like, people are dying.
Right, God.
Just crying over her like diamond or whatever.
Mexican Gothic and the Kardashians are two things that I very, very much am not. I actually would read Mexican Gothic again if I didn't have to look at a Kardashian ever again in my life.
Okay.
That's how much I dislike those people.
Okay. Alrighty then. On that anti-Kardashian note, we finish our episode of not Sublimely Gothic, oh my God, with Rambling Raven Puffs.
Yes,
going back in time, and we'll tune in next week and we'll go over chapters 15 and 16, The Goblin's Revenge and Godric's Hollow. Finally, we're gonna go to Godric's Hollow.
Good times.
All right, then, catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophie Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophie Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophieMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophie Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophieMareStudios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. That was the Sophie Mare Studios podcast.